Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Something's crazy. Okay. Okay, so we've got a problem with the switchboard, and I'm just going to go ahead with the show. Introductions. I am Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, and I'm speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is March 10th, 2010, and I want to thank the hundreds of listeners who have tuned in, have downloaded the archives from past shows, and have encouraged us to move forward with the programming. We have four shows every week. We have on Monday Studying the Organon with me, and on Wednesday we have Organic Gardening and Agro-Homeopathy with Kaviraj, and also we've had special guests call in like Mark Moody of Considera, who is talking about biodiversity, and then Thursday we've got Vaccinations and Your Rights each at noon, and then on the first Thursday of each month, we have invited Greg Glazer to talk about constitutional law. And finally, on Sunday evening at 11, I'm doing a meditation as a gift to the Twitterverse, to the Internet, to anyone who needs some relaxation and stress reduction. And I could use a little bit now. I figured out, in order for me to get onto the chat, I may have a problem with the sound. So we will see how that goes. In the meantime, I want to thank those who are in the live chat right now and listening. Okay, we've got Eurochick, Literary Scribes, Victor, and Alan. We're all in there waving hello. I want to thank you. It's like romper room. You know what that is. So, Alan, are you getting some sound in okay?
I'm hearing you just fine, Debbie.
Oh, good. We've got a good connection then. And we're going to be continuing our discussion regarding New Hampshire Bill and the paper that you have written to support those people who want freedoms and rights for their personal health care. And then we have a lot of other issues because the month of March was just full of activity for health rights and vaccination rights. So I would invite you to go ahead and talk about maybe a wrap-up of how far we went with House Bill 416, adding an exemption from immunizations for conscientious beliefs. Okay.
Well, let me see if I can start with just a real quick review. We've spent a couple of shows recently going through this. I was invited by an activist in New Hampshire to write something in support of their efforts to get a conscientious exemption to immunizations passed in New Hampshire. And in putting this together, I realized that not only is a conscientious or philosophical exemption justifiable, but in my view, as I put together the argument for this, it's morally and ethically compelled. I mean, there's And we'll just dive into this again. Let me give a real quick wrap-up of what we covered previously. The first point was that the credit given to vaccines for 20th century childhood infectious disease declines is misplaced. The primary point being that the majority of infectious disease decline preceded vaccines, and in a couple of instances, well-documented instances, vaccines even reversed pre-existing disease declines, at least temporarily. The second point concerns the fact, I would assert, that a reliable vaccine disease risk-benefit assessment is not really possible, and that's because the data, the mortality data on the diseases and the injury and mortality data on vaccine injury and death is just simply not precise information. We really can't count those things with any sort of reliable accuracy. The reporting is not at all consistent, especially on the vaccine injuries and vaccine deaths. And so we really don't have any hard numbers to work with to do a comparison. What we do know is that both diseases and vaccines can cause deaths and with vaccines, permanent injuries. The third point is the idea that an unvaccinated person poses a risk of harm to others. That really is without merit. It the primary argument there relies on the idea of the so-called herd immunity theory that says if most people are immunized, then the entire population is immunized. Well, there have been many, many instances in the medical literature that have shown highly and even fully vaccinated populations having disease outbreaks and for a number of different diseases, and we've seen that even in recent history in California with pertussis outbreaks and in New York and New Jersey with outbreaks of other mumps, I think it was, up there in recent months. So we know that this happens regularly, and it's been documented in medical literature over the years as well. So the whole herd immunity rationale for vaccines is really brought into question by the medical community itself. The next point concerns that mandatory vaccination, that there are effective alternatives, and by mandating vaccines, you sort of remove a citizen's right effectively to consider and choose other means of disease prevention. And we know from a recent incident in Cuba back in the fall of 2008 that homeoprophylaxis can be very effective, more effective, doesn't carry the risk of death and permanent disability that vaccines do, and it's a fraction of the cost of vaccines. And we know that, for example, studies show that vitamin D is more effective than vaccines at preventing the flu. So why would we be taking flu shots? We should be taking vitamin D. Doesn't come with a risk of injury and death like vaccines does, probably cheaper than vaccines. We then went on and talked about conflicts of interest, and in the way that I designed my particular paper on this, we were looking at the various federal and international agencies, and there are conflicts of interest in the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices. There are conflicts in the CDC. There's kind of a revolving door, frankly, between industry and agencies, which makes objectivity on the part of the agencies very difficult. The British Medical Journal suggested that the leadership of the World Health Organization should resign because of the conflicts of interest and the mishandling of the swine flu pandemic. So we're seeing not just radical fringe people complaining, but we're seeing in some instances mainstream people and organizations in the medical mainstream who are acknowledging publicly some of the very serious problems that go on with conflicts of interest.
And also the fact that the statistics show that it is the highly educated population who is choosing not to vaccinate. Now, that goes against what you would imagine, right? I mean, it's people who are investigating the facts.
If vaccines are truly safe and effective and there's strong evidence supporting that assertion, then you would think the people who were more likely to, or better equipped, let's say, in terms of education, to explore and understand these issues, that they would come out in favor of vaccines. And what we're seeing is exactly the opposite, as you point out. Vaccine rates, I think, are increasing at the other end of the educational spectrum, but they are exemptions and waivers are increasing in more highly educated people. So it suggests that those people who have the better ability, at least intellectually and academically, to investigate and make their own decisions on this issue, are increasing numbers of them are in fact doing that and coming out with coming away from their assessment with concerns about vaccines. Certainly consistent with my own journey. I can recall having, for example, as a teenager, heard a radio report talking about how a religious group refused vaccines and thinking that these people had to be nuts. You know, believing in God is fine, but don't be an idiot. And if you would have told me in my early adult years that one day I'd be fighting for religious freedom and that I would be an attorney and that I'd be legislatively active, I would have been on the ground laughing, frankly, because those were farthest thing from my mind at that point. And here I am doing something. So to anybody who's in their young or middle adult years or younger, you know, you never know what's going to happen later on in life. Anything is possible. So leave the door open there. But I wanted to move on to the next point here, and let's dive into this a little bit now that we sort of caught up on previous shows. And this point I titled, Reliance on the Pharmaceutical Industry is Severely Misplaced. And by reliance on the pharmaceutical industry, of course, that's the industry that creates and manufactures the vaccines that we're all required to use. And if vaccines were the only way of addressing the issue, I wouldn't see at least on one level, a fundamental problem, but just the idea that we have different ways of addressing this and different modalities, that the government's going to mandate any particular one, in and of itself suggests a problem to me. Government maybe should take on the role of providing complete and objective information from which consumers and citizens can then you know, use that as part of their own investigative process to come to whatever decision they come to. But when government goes the next step of mandating one particular industry's solution to that, that raises serious questions to me, given that I know and believe that there are other ways to deal with the issue.
You have points documenting quite recently in December of 2009 that the World Health Organization had reported, and this is quotes from their own documentation,
their own website
says corruption in the pharmaceutical sector occurs throughout all stages of the medicine's chain, from research and development to dispensing and promotion, unquote. So all down the line, there can be some error. There can be some human error going on between when there's research and development or when a vaccine is being produced. There's a lot of places where we can have something that can turn a positive into a negative, something that could potentially be helpful to human existence and turn it into something that's going to harm individuals. So we have to think about that, and we don't have enough checks and balances throughout the system that is being developed. And what concerns me the most is the power that many influential people have to direct the WHO or government or pharmaceutical industry, because they have a lot of money, they have a big name, or that is their agenda. And this is quite frightening to me, that the people's voice is not being heard, and that there's nothing to, it's like a steamroller that doesn't stop. There's nothing to hold it back and say, whoa, look at this and look at the actual facts on the ground of what's happening there.
Well, I want to take your word error, though, and expand on that just a little bit, because this quote from the World Health Organization uses the word corruption. And while that certainly implies error, the word error alone suggests the possibility of negligence or, you know, unintentional error. And the word corruption really goes considerably beyond, above and beyond mere negligence or mere human error, which, you know, we can always expect to happen to one degree or another. And let me give you some specific examples, and this is from the next point in the paper here. The pharmaceutical industry regularly engages in criminal behavior, and this, I think, is more in line with the WHO's use of the word corruption. For example, in 2008, Merck was fined $650 million under the False Claims Act. But the real topper, and I've got a long list here, and I'm not going to cite every single one of them, but in 2009, this is the top one so far, 2009, Pfizer was assessed a $1 billion criminal fine along with a $1.3 billion civil fine. And I have to underscore the fact that when you're talking about crimes, criminal fine, there's a real high standard in our country, as well there should be, for criminal conviction. Now, these are settlements. I don't think these are convictions per se, but a criminal fine, that means they knew exactly what they were doing. They knew that what they were doing was unlawful. They did it anyway. You know, we can speculate as to why that happens. But one of the reasons that Pfizer's criminal fine, the $1 billion portion of the $2.3 billion combination criminal and civil fines, was that this was the fourth settlement since 2002 for Pfizer over illegal marketing, and the fine just got bigger because they kept doing the same behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to assume that recurring behavior of an industry, not just one company now, this is something that's happening throughout the industry. I have a long list of companies that have had
Have any of the individuals within the company had a repercussion, when you punish somebody in your family, there's some consequences to be paid. And just if I've got a wad of money in my pocket and I can just hand it over and not la-di-da, you know, it's not going to affect me in any deep way. It has to personally affect somebody in order for the behavior to stop. So is that happening at all?
To the best of my knowledge, it's very rare for an actual individual to serve prison time. I don't think any of these pharmaceutical executives, when they have a settlement to pay a fine, civil and or criminal fines, nobody's going to jail for that. And that's part of the reason. I think if we had enforcement of these, that we could pin the problem down or the responsibility for it down to a single high-level official in the company who knew and condoned the behavior, and then these people served time, I think there's a likelihood that the practices would go down perhaps dramatically. But here's a list. See, it's been close to $1 billion a year for the last 20 years, but about 75% of those fines have happened in the last 5 years, so there's a significant increase in the problem recently.
Mm-hmm.
And these are companies like AstraZeneca, Abbott Labs, Bristol-Myers Squibb, SmithKline-Beecham, Schering Plough, Bayer Corporation. You know, big names in the pharmaceutical industry. It's not just one or two companies who are going awry here, going astray. It's the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an increasing problem. And my point, you know, of all this, what does all this have to do with vaccines? Well, here, in kind of summary, it's like this, that I don't feel that anyone should ever be required in any sort of absolute or mandatory way to take a product from an industry that routinely engages in criminal behavior. I mean, there's a serious ethical problem with our
that
being required
really good
to take. Yeah, with our
good,
being required.
Very, very good point, Alan. You know, like, who do you trust? And if they're doing all of this shenanigans, then you have no idea what's in those vaccines.
Well, and there are some questions raised. I mean, the FDA has a very specific process, procedure. You know, they have to – vaccines have to be licensed. They have to meet certain standards and so forth. You know, there's a separate question there about are the requirements of a strict enough nature the amount of harm
about, that – You're talking about more about the – rather than what is actually in – the vaccine and how it's manufactured, you're really more concerned about the legalities of the power structure, the power of who is able to tell a citizen what they must do to their body. Is that what you're saying?
Well, for this particular point, it's really an ethical issue. You know, if you and I commit a crime, we go to jail for it, unless it's a very minor one, or, you know, traffic violations maybe technically fall under criminal code and we pay fines or whatever. But these people commit crimes, you know, to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars or even billions of dollars in some cases, and yet they pay a fine. In fact, there was at least a couple instances I just found in my research where the court says, you know, the damage here is some high number, hundreds of millions of dollars. I don't remember exact figures, but what we're going to actually fine you is some lower figure, you know, a fraction of that, a third or fourth of that, because this is what we have determined the company is capable of paying. And this is very troubling. We see this in a more specific level with the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, where they were going out of business because of lawsuits for the harm caused by their vaccines, and yet we as a society say, but we have to have vaccines, so what we're going to do is put in law that protects these companies from liability. This is what we're seeing in kind of a larger sense, same concept in a larger sense with the pharmaceutical industry, in that a court says, oh, we can't really fine you the full amount of the damage here because you can't afford it, so we'll lower it to something that you can afford. It's like somehow they do something wrong that should put them out of business, and if it's so bad that it puts them out of business, they should go out of business. There's a really compelling argument to say if the harm from their products is so bad that it puts them out of business, they should go out of business. And yet we as a society say, no, we need them even though their harm is that bad.
I think that kind of goes across, Alan, that kind of concept goes across the board, the bailouts that we've seen economically, the auto industry, all sorts of things across the board we're seeing. We're kind of dependent upon these companies to provide certain products or services or whatever it might be, and yet we need to kind of deconstruct what is a built-in system and restructure it and put it into its proper place. And unfortunately, what you're saying is that they're getting away scot-free when originally there was a method put, a process put into place for the vaccine.
The Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System.
Yeah, the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Now, that's almost like not effective anymore. And if they are not beholden to live up to what they're supposed to do. So,
well, let's be fair here. $1 billion fine is not something to sneeze at. But the obvious fact is that, or apparent fact is that, even fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars, they keep doing the behavior. It must be that it's profitable on the whole to continue engaging in the behavior. And, you know, the question is, you know, who is hurt in what way and so forth. If I may, I'd like to digress briefly here because I see a reference in the chat to the Nuremberg Code. And the question
is,
why isn't that used, you know, to hold these people accountable? And it's a really good question. And there is a really good answer to it as well. And this came up a lot during the pandemic. You know, there's experimentation going on here. They fast-track these vaccines. They don't have time to really thoroughly test them. And we're being experimented on. Shouldn't we have a right to say no? And if any state or local health authority had decided that there was a severe enough basis that they had mandated the vaccines, and as you know, Debbie, from my comments previously, many states have laws that in an emergency, if vaccines are mandated, exemptions go out the window. And, you know, so what about the Nuremberg Code or the Declaration of Helsinki? Well, as a starting point, those documents are not binding law. It's not legal authority that anybody is, as a matter of law here in the U.S., required to adhere to, other than the extent to which language from documents like these documents happen to be incorporated into laws enacted here in the U.S. And there are some laws that have pulled in language similar to or from the Nuremberg Code to prevent, for example, federal funds to be spent on research that would violate some of those principles. But the Nuremberg Code itself, the Helsinki Declaration, there's you know, a number of other kinds of documents that we might cite that have these profound principles. They are not binding law. Now, there's also, though, to be perfectly fair about it, there, you know, during the swine flu pandemic, for example, people were screaming constitutional, this, that, and the other, Nuremberg Code, and so forth. And as a matter of concept and principle, I was on board with those people. As a matter of law, it's a separate question, though. For every person who's going to say, oh, use of emergency vaccines is experimental and violates the Nuremberg Code, for example, there's somebody else who will point out that, well, under the law, you know, there are certain emergency, declared emergency changes things, and actually there's nothing here in this particular application or use of vaccines in this way that violates the Nuremberg Code or that violates the Constitution. And there are, at least on a technical, legal, intellectual level, there are arguments on both sides, if not many sides. And the fact that we happen to see it a particular way doesn't make it the quote-unquote correct one. This, again, goes back to the same issue I keep harping on over and over and over again because it's so important. There are a lot of people who have ideas about what they think their rights are. Many times we need to distinguish between what we think our rights should be and what they technically are. And again, where the rubber meets the road in this for the vast majority of time is going to be in statutes and regulations. And if we don't like what's happening and the way things are playing out, sometimes you can challenge that and win if it's really not happening correctly. But I have seen, on the whole, vaccine litigation that tries to deal in a larger way with vaccine rights issues, it has not been successful. I was part of a team of attorneys around the country, I'm proud to say, who were fighting the licensure of swine flu vaccines. We didn't win. We had some folks on that who were seasoned veteran federal attorneys. I frankly was a newbie on the team, but was proud to be, you know, involved and to chip in and support that where I could. But bottom line is we had some terrific attorneys there. It didn't happen. Others have done other kinds of cases that just haven't panned out. So if you have a clear right that someone's violating on a personal level and have the emotional and financial stamina to sue, I say go for it, because a lot of those cases can be won. But some of the larger ones that are looking at broader issues, a case that attempted to get a court to rule that West Virginia had to have a religious exemption. I was cheering for them on the sidelines, but I was very skeptical of the outcome, and they lost. I just didn't think that there was law to support that outcome. There was another case in South Carolina.
Okay, so the cases that can possibly win are ones that are narrowly defined? Is that what you're saying?
That concern an individual's right to refuse vaccines where there is a law that says the individual has that right. There's a case in South Carolina where a nurse was saying, well, in a general sense, I have a right to decide what goes into my body, and my employer can't make me get a vaccine. Kind of a personal rights issue as opposed to, say, a religious right or something else. And as much as I wanted that nurse to win, I didn't think she had a chance, and she lost. And the reason is because historically in this country, the individual surrenders their personal preference to the safety and well-being of the majority. Now, I don't agree that vaccines provide that, but that's the common belief in our medical system and in our society as a whole right now.
So you're saying we need to take a close look at the actual effectiveness of vaccines and give them enough data to say this is not what is going to protect the country. That's really
what
you're saying.
What I'm saying is we need to have that fight with the legislators and not with the courts, because the courts don't have the authority to address some of these issues. I mean, the lawsuits that were filed with and through attorneys, for the most part, I think were attorneys who felt they had a legitimate argument but even those, many of them are losing. As distinct from, let's say, a hospital that rejects a nurse who has a legitimate religious objection to vaccines, there's federal law that supports that right, and that nurse has a real good chance in court. And if she wants to, generally speaking, if she wants to or he wants to fight that case in court, I say go for it, because if the facts support it, you've got the law that backs you up on it. But some of these other cases were real uphill battles.
So now let's finish up on this particular point, that this is all part, just for those folks who are listening in, this is all part of a paper that was written by Alan to support the New Hampshire House Bill 416, adding an exemption for immunizations for conscientious beliefs. And he itemized a whole list of reasons to support that, and it appeared that there were many valid reasons why parents would decline or make a choice not to vaccinate. And this was a paper that you sent into the legislatures over there, I believe, Alan?
Well, and, to an activist who then passed it on to a committee. I think this is probably standard procedure in most, if not all, states, and at the federal level as well. When a new bill is introduced, it'll go to committees. And if it survives committee scrutiny, then it'll go out to the larger legislature for debate and eventually vote. But so this paper got out to committees. By the way, this paper is available online. It's at the vaccinerights.com website. If you follow the links from the homepage, the link there to legislative issues and then legislative projects, this will be one of the
This paper could be used as a model for further papers in other states. And basically, today's point was that when an industry is engaging in criminal behavior, that no one should ever be required, absolutely, to take a product from that industry when their moral and ethical values comes into question. And you should have a right to say no to criminal pharmaceutical industry when they're forcing their product upon you. Did we finish philosophical exemptions are time-tested and safe? Did we talk about that yet, or should we do that a little bit?
We have not, and that's a very quick point. Basically, there are approximately 20 states, a minority of states, but they represent a majority of U.S. citizens, probably because California is one of those, that have philosophical exemptions. And really, it's just kind of a practical matter. If having these exemptions was causing serious infectious disease problems, that is, because, you know, the reason that the states that don't have philosophical exemptions say they don't want to have one is because they're concerned that this will open the door for more people to more easily refuse vaccines, and then we're going to have a problem when you cross that herd immunity threshold and suddenly there's going to be, you know, rampant disease everywhere again.
Mm-hmm.
So far, that has just not happened. States that have the philosophical exemption, if the presence of that exemption was a problem, those states would be shutting down that exemption option really quickly, I can assure you, because the pharmaceutical industry would like to see it happen whether there's an infectious disease justification for it or not. It's taken away, cutting away from their profits.
So when you're talking, you know, legally, you're always telling us we have to look at precedents, and that moves us forward into what we should be doing for the present and the future. So you're saying that the way that the law has been set up with a philosophical exemption over time has never caused a problem, and therefore there's no, it's basically set a precedent that it's fine, and why should we change that, that we should continue to provide this philosophical exemption for people in more than 20 states, I guess.
Oh, I'm sure there's any number of instances where health authorities have tried to attribute outbreaks or other concerns to the presence of philosophical exemptions, but what I'm saying is that overall, if these exemptions were really causing any sort of serious persistent problems, the states would get rid of them. I mean, they wouldn't have them anymore. Well, we're going to see this battle continue because, as you know, there's been battles in a few states recently where citizens are trying to expand rights, as New Hampshire is doing now, or health authorities are trying to restrict exemption rights. You know, the battle goes both ways, and we'll see how this plays out, but more and more people, citizens, are coming to the realization that there are problems here that they would like to have the right to say no and not have to justify it for religious or medical reasons.
Okay.
You know, we're gonna, it's playing out now, and we'll continue to do so. It'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Okay. Now, the point number 8 on your document, medical experts disagree about vaccine safety and effectiveness. In a way, we have covered that a number of times in a number of shows. Is there something specific regarding that point that you wanted to make?
Well, for our purposes today, I think we should leave it primarily as a summary because that's a topic that could be its own series of shows, and there are lots of people addressing that topic in an ongoing way in various formats on the internet, some of them live shows, webinars, radio shows, and documentation and so forth. But I would like, I guess, just quickly to say that I'm of the impression that there's a growing number, not of not just people in the general population, but of medical experts as well. I have heard any number of instances of medical people who quietly believe there are problems with vaccines, but who will not or cannot speak out for fear of losing their job or being attacked professionally. And that's a real shame that we don't have a culture and society where people can feel free to express themselves without being retaliated against. Because it certainly contributes to the suppression of complete information and continues to make it more difficult than it should be for people to get the right to make informed decisions.
Right, and, but, and most people have seen the little video by Suzanne Humphreys, which is on the front page of Homeopathy World Community. There are a lot of people who are doing videos, who are being outspoken, who are medical experts in their field, and there are a lot of webinars being done also. So you can take a look at that. Let's go ahead with point number 9. The vaccination raises a fundamental rights question. So this is more of a legal point being made, that the government mandate of immunizations is absolutely. Go ahead.
And it is, in one sense, a very simple concern, but perhaps very complicated or more complicated or complex when you ask how do you apply this to our legal system. But the simple truth of the matter is vaccines come with a risk of death or serious and permanent injury. And at this point in time, we do not have science that can tell us what the risk is, who specifically is vulnerable or more likely to suffer injury or death, and is there something we could do apart from redesigning vaccines to prevent that? Or is there some way to redesign vaccines, you know, to prevent that? Yes, the answer is homeoprophylaxis. But, you know, in a society where the vast majority of disease decline preceded the vaccines that are now mandated, so, you know, again, vaccines are taking unfair and undue credit for disease declines, where there are actually instances, documented instances, where vaccines have been counterproductive. In fact, I've just seen again this week information that I had seen originally surfaced during the pandemic. They're saying that research from a couple of different countries now shows that people who had been vaccinated for the seasonal flu had several times the risk of contracting the swine flu. And, you know, vaccines can actually be counterproductive. You know, you don't hear that in mainstream news, unfortunately, but the science is there for that now.
Okay, I'd like to look that information up so we have that for the next show. I'd like to be able to provide that for folks to hear about. So you're saying that we don't have enough facts to make such broad scope mandates on a society. And usually, parents usually, when their child gets vaccinated and there is an adverse effect, they go back to the doctor and say, I really don't want to revaccinate my child. And then they do, and then they're sorry. And then they say, you know, my other child is almost very, very similar to this one who had an adverse effect. And so now I am being very cautious as a parent to protect my child. And then again, so within families, we might have susceptibilities to having an adverse effect when given a vaccine. And those, you know, when you're saying how do we reevaluate and take a better look at who gets vaccinated, this is something that we must listen to the parents, listen to the people who are feeling this way about what's going on in their personal family life. So that's one way that we could potentially change the law, that if you have had an adverse effect in your family, then you might have the option to opt out or have an exemption.
Well, we have that with medical exemptions, but the problem is it's ineffective under current law, and that's because the vaccine's connection to the adverse events caused by them are often denied by the medical profession, not based on some sort of specific investigation to see whether or not there's a connection, but just sort of out of a blanket denial, which just completely misses. I don't know how to. It's just an unethical thing that doctors do. We saw this.
They're just not making the connection. They're just not.
Well, they're refusing to even investigate the connection, and this was probably no more disturbing to me than during the swine flu pandemic, when pregnant women would get the swine flu vaccine and then miscarry, and doctors would just say, oh, it doesn't have anything to do with the vaccine, without taking any steps to see if they could find out whether there's any evidence to support either a causal connection or the absence of a causal connection. And, you know, the rationale is, well, you know, miscarriages happen a certain percentage of the time anyway. It's just a coincidence that the vaccine, you know, was close in time to it. Well, that's a fair generalization, but it's not a rationale that in any scientific way whatsoever can be used to explain any specific instance where that happened. It might explain some percentage of them, but who knows what the percentage is. But again, the point is, with any specific case, you can't explain a specific instance with a generalization. It's a non-logical, non-scientific connection. And for doctors to be jumping in on that sort of a denial bandwagon without looking at any individual case to see whether or not there's a connection, what kind of investigation medically and scientifically can you make to find out whether in this specific case, any specific case, there is a connection? And that's the kind of mentality that perpetuates harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
harm.
Yeah, we have to ask our medical professionals to listen to us and to say, stop what you're doing. This is important to us. I want you to investigate it. I want you to look around and see, is it just me and my family, or is this happening throughout the practice of providing these vaccinations, and so many people are telling you that this is occurring, and we're making the connection of whether it's the proximity within, if they have a limit of 10 days and we're saying it's happening 6 weeks later or a year later or whatever, when the parent is making the connection, and the medical professionals must stop and listen and take this information in to really investigate it without just, as you say, whitewashing it and just saying, no, it's not possible.
You have to understand that the doctors work in a climate where it is very difficult for them to do the moral or ethical and sometimes even legal requirement. I mean, doctors are legally required to report vaccine adverse events, but polls show that the vast majority of them don't. And probably the reason they don't is there's no enforcement mechanism. There's no penalty for not reporting one, so the law that says they have to is sort of meaningless. But I had a conversation, just to give you one quick anecdotal example, I had a conversation with a nurse from Washington State a while back who was telling me that a child developed diabetes after a vaccine. The doctors quietly acknowledged that it was because of the vaccine, and the nurse was threatened with losing her job for having raised the point about, you know, are they going to report this as they're required, and, you know, shouldn't they report this? They're supposed to. And there's no way in the world they were going to report that. And it's just really,
so
really sad.
How did we find out about it if it wasn't reported?
Well, she knew about it and was talking with me, and I knew about it because she shared that with me. But that doesn't mean it got reported in any formal way, for example, mm-hmm. to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System.
I do want to say that I feel for physicians because they have a huge job and they are under a lot of pressure. They have so many people that they have to care for, and it's a lot of paperwork, and additional paperwork is really difficult for them, and there's a lot of red tape. I mean, I do feel that they
It's not about convenience. It's about, look what happened to Andrew Wakefield. That's what it's about. It's about literally their lives, their livelihood, their income, their families, their cars, their houses. They feel in a more fundamental level. And you know, Andy's a good example of, you know, a basis for that feeling. Now, you know, it's easy for me perhaps to say from a more idealistic point of view, if there were more Andys out there, this would perhaps shift the paradigm somewhere. But the problem is that everybody feels like they're isolated and alone, and if they stand out, their neck's going to get cut off, and that's not only going to not encourage more people, it's going to discourage them. Somehow we as a society have to get past that, and I don't have a quick answer for you about how we do that, but the first step may be to acknowledge the climate and culture in the medical profession as it currently exists. Maybe there would be more doctors who would be willing to address in a more general way the fact that there is a culture that prevents them from being open and honest about their opinions or about their scientific findings or about what they're really seeing in their practices. It might be something that, you know, there have to be laws enacted that say nobody can be penalized or punished. But there are ways you can do that. It's like the nurses who come to me and say, how do I avoid the vaccines? And I say, here's a procedure. And if they get rejected anyway, you know, if you get rejected falsely, you know, you could sue. The problem is, even if they sue and win and get their job back, 2 weeks later they can be fired for no reason at all. And the hospitals, in many instances, have the legal authority to do that. So why would you spend thousands of dollars on a lawsuit to win your job? So there's something fundamentally wrong there.
Right.
With a system that even if you're right and can win in court, you still lose in life. There's something wrong, you know, with a system like that.
Right. And the medical profession itself is undergoing tremendous transition and change and difficulty just maintaining itself. So to go in and investigate standards and morals for them is going to be even more difficult. There's a whole shift in the medical profession right now, and they are undergoing change within their profession. So do we have any other major points that we want to talk about? We've got about 9 or 10 minutes left, and I know that there was a lot of other things going on in the medical environment, the vaccination world there.
Well, why don't we do a quick summary of this paper that we've been talking about for, you know, maybe three, if not more,
yes,
sessions at this point, just to kind of get some closure on that. And if we run out of time, Debbie, of course, there's no shortage of issues for the next week's show. And I do want to remind listeners that this is a weekly show. I know I do most of my promotion when Greg is here, but it is, and he's here once a month on the first Thursday of the month. But this is a weekly show, and we welcome people to listen, to call or write in their questions, try to get to them, you know, when we can. But here, with what I think is a moral and philosophical imperative, that all states and federal jurisdictions have allow and have and offer a philosophical or conscientious exemption option to vaccines. And I'll just give a real quick summary here to the points then. Credit to vaccines for 20th century infectious disease declines is misplaced. The data shows that the majority of declines preceded vaccines. Data for accurate risk-benefit analyses of vaccines and diseases is really not available. We don't have hard figures. So the government really doesn't have an adequate means for determining with any sort of reliable precision whether or not there's a net benefit from vaccines. Claims that vaccines pose a risk of harm to the vaccinated are really unfounded. I mean, if the vaccines work, how can an unvaccinated person be a risk? That's only part of the answer, but the more full answer is in the paper itself. There's actually evidence that shows that vaccines in some instances were counterproductive. And, of course, that's no more concern, I think, than when you're talking about emergency vaccines that are fast-tracked. They're made more quickly. They skip some of the procedures and don't have at all the same kind of research to back them up. And yet we have even fewer rights to refuse emergency vaccines, vaccines that by their nature are ones that we have even more reason to be concerned about than the routine immunization. So if anything, from that point of view, we should have more rights to refuse them, not less rights. From a state's point of view, emergencies are serious issues, and we can't have people just sort of, you know, opting out willy-nilly. They got to all get the vaccine. So, you know, they have their side of it, but it just doesn't hold up under scrutiny. There are viable, proven alternatives to immunizations. There are all kinds of conflicts of interest at all levels, especially in the federal and international agencies. The vaccine industry is a highly questionable one in the sense that, and to the extent that the industry and throughout the industry are engaged routinely and regularly in criminal behavior, knowingly violating laws, presumably because it's profitable on the whole to do that. Philosophical exemptions are time-tested. States that allow them are not pulling them because of all the presumed increase in diseases that those states that don't have them argue would occur if they also had them. There's not evidence to really support that. The medical profession, slow as it is, and for the reasons we discussed, if not additional reasons as well, is nonetheless slowly coming around. There's a growing number of medical professionals. Really, from my point of view, anybody who takes a serious, objective look at this issue, it's virtually impossible to come away without some concern. There may be a spectrum that people fall on depending on what information they've looked at, what sources they consider credible, and so forth. But the evidence calling immunizations into question is just so abundant and so clear. I just don't believe that anybody who really, truly takes a serious, in-depth look at it can come away with anything but one version or another of an alternative view on vaccines. And we're seeing more and more doctors do that. And people like Susan Humphreys, you know, she stated in writing that the reason she can talk about an alternative view is because she can make a living if they take her license. She underscores the very point we were just talking about, that it's very difficult.
How does she make a living if they take away her license?
Oh, I don't remember what she said, but the point was is that she doesn't have the same vulnerability mm-hmm. that other doctors have for right. taking the risk of speaking her mind and speaking the truth and speaking out. And the point is that she underscores my point that it's very difficult for doctors, even the ones who maybe have looked at this and do see problems, it's very difficult for them to be outspoken about it because they put their entire profession at risk for doing that.
Right.
So it's a hard road. We've got to reform the medical industry in such a way that doctors are able to have access to complete information and not just what they've been spoon-fed ultimately by the pharmaceutical industry, but also that there's a clear space for them to speak whatever view they have without any sort of repercussion for doing
right.
so.
Right. They have their hands bound and shackled because alternative practices are not condoned freely in all states, and therefore they don't have the right to suggest to somebody just take vitamin D or go get some acupuncture or do a sauna or whatever alternative mode to healing rather than giving them a prescription. So is there anything else?
And then the final point in simplified form is that vaccines, the bottom line is vaccines carry a risk of permanent injury or death. If a product carries with it a risk of serious injury or death, and you don't have any way ahead of time of knowing what that risk is for you,
mm-hmm.
how can your government justify requiring you to take it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that again, it's just a fundamental rights question. If it's not unconstitutional to mandate vaccines, given that reality, it ought to be.
And one other point, when you go in for your vaccination, how many physicians or the assistant physicians will itemize for you the downfalls, the risks that are potentially there and the percentage of risk for a child or for an adult?
They don't even know what the risks are. You know, when I went in to talk to my doctor with my oldest son when he was a baby, that they handed us the vaccine information paper that I later learned they're required to. It says 1 in 1,000,000 children die from a vaccine or something to that effect. And the doctor I spoke to said, that doesn't ever happen. That doesn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know. They don't even know what's in the vaccines. Ask a pediatrician sometime, you know, hey, do you know what the ingredients in the vaccine are?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sherry Tenpenny, who's now one of the most outspoken doctors against vaccination, when she was first confronted with that question, before she became informed on the issue, she thought there was just, you know, maybe some saline, there's the antigen, you know, that triggers antibodies. She had no idea. Doctors don't know. They don't realize that there's this long list of toxic carcinogenic ingredients in every vaccine, but there is.
Right. So that should be part of the mandate, that we become informed by the physician before we're given the vaccine, which might kind of scare you
but
away from doing it.
But the physician be fully informed before he inform
yeah.
us, because, you know,
right.
they're all happy to give you their opinion right now. It's just a very uninformed one at this point for most of them.
Okay. Well, we're just about out of time, and we're going to bring up a whole new series come next week with Alan. Don't forget to take a look at his vaccination ebook. There is a link on the front page of HWC. And I want to thank you again for being with us and sharing your knowledge and your experience in this area of vaccinations and your rights in the United States. So we're going to close the show, and I want to thank you. Okay.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, bye-bye, Alan.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. Thank you.
never got explained. That radiance grows brighter to the world will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one we are free. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one we are free.